Hi, y'all. This is Kristen Chenoweth.
Hi, I'm Gloria Stefan.
This is Sarah Bareilles.
Hi, I'm Patti LuPone.
This is Lin-Manuel Miranda. You're listening to the Broadway Podcast Network.
Attention all theater lovers, this Sunday, April 21st, Broadway Podcast Network is holding the first ever Broadway Podfest, a full day of podcast recordings with some of your favorite Broadway stars, live from the Museum of Broadway, which is right in the heart of Times Square. The day begins at 11 a.m. Eastern and features a full day of programming that you don't want to miss. Visit bpn.fm/podfest to get all the details and register to attend for free. That's bpn.fm/podfest.
Oh, is my mic too hot?
No, but you are.
Wow, thank you. Now that should be the first line of the episode.
I think all this is going to stay in, so I should just be professional now. Hello, everybody. Welcome to a bonus episode of Broadway Breakdown. I have with me our series regular, possible 1974 pedophile. Jury's still out.
Can they not see my hair?
No.
Well, then you're just casting aspersions upon me.
Exactly. Well, I might take a screenshot so everyone can know. You need to put your glasses on too, though.
Okay. Well, for those who don't care and are just listening, I have like a 1970s shag now.
Yes.
I was wearing my blue light glasses and I had like, you know, like when a bad guy is in an anime and his eyes just turn into shiny little... So I just look like a bad guy.
Yeah. Hold on a second. Sorry. This is Allie Gordon, everybody.
Hi.
Hi. How are you today, Miss Gordon?
Pretty good. My it's mid-December. My radiators have been going nonstop. Mm-hmm. My skin is melting off my face. You know?
You know. Typical New York December stuff.
Just like that romantic. You know, they never talk about that in the fucking Christmas movies.
About what?
Like you know, when it's like a New York Christmas miracle. No one's ever like, my skin is falling off because my radiators have been going nonstop since December 1st and I'm dying.
What Christmas movie do you watch where they have a New York Christmas miracle?
There are always Christmas movies in New York.
Well, so maybe I need to watch more then because so the topic at hand today, everybody, there is a film, an opus magnus, if you will.
Yes.
That I discovered towards the end of November as I started doing a holiday movie marathon with my roommate who I'm related to, otherwise known as my mother.
Directly related.
That's my marketing term for her. My roommate.
Yeah, it's like when kids don't want to admit that their parents are really famous and they're like, oh yeah, I mean, they're in the business. And you're like, who are they? And like, Robert Redford. And you're like, oh, okay. So yeah, they're in the business.
I love that was your go-to, Robert Redford. But yeah, we came across this movie, I think, on our fourth day, which was a mistake because nothing has matched it since.
Nothing will, ever.
Ever will. It is the epic tour de force holiday clusterfuck that is Dolly Parton's Christmas on the Square.
Yes. I will say, though, I think I watched it entirely sober.
What was that like?
Shocking.
Were you just super aware of everything that was happening then?
Yeah, I mean, the truth is it asks a lot of questions and answers none of them, which I think is actually kind of brave. It's a movie that asks so many questions and says, actually, I don't need to tell you. Like, for example, like, why is the mall complex called the Cheetah Mall?
Because say it out loud.
Yeah, Cheetah Mall.
Yeah.
But then they're like, are you like, oh, because of course, as like a person who watches TV and films and shit, you're like, oh shit, they're taking advantage of her too. This is going to be a bad deal. Turns out, no.
No, it's just a play on words that they decided to do.
It's just a play on words, and, yeah. And it's a question that is asked that is never answered.
Also, you're thinking about it so intensely. I describe it as the movie equivalent of a cosmopolitan with a crucifix-shaped candy cane garnish inside of it that you drink at Flaming Saddles while both It's a Wonderful Life and gay porn play in the background.
Yes, I think that that's very apt. I think that's basically it. And I think that if you heard that sentence and were excited by it, you should watch it. I think if you are expecting anything, else, don't watch it. I would not necessarily call it emotionally compelling. I would not necessarily call it plot driven. I would not necessarily call it character driven. It is a train that has gone off the rails. And if you are like willing to just like ride that train like a bucking bronco, you'll have a great time.
Yes. I'll say this for it. It tells you exactly what kind of movie it is in the first 3 minutes.
1,000,000%.
If the first 3 minutes don't immediately make your jaw drop and make you go, where is this going? First of all, I don't want to know you. You sound like an awful time to be around. Second of all, you will not like the rest of this movie.
I will say also not only within the first couple minutes of the movie are you introduced to like every single character who says who they are and who, the relationship to the Christine Baranski character, like outright, like an improv scene, mm-hmm. but also they cut the Dolly Parton character, who's like a beggar woman wearing like a Grisabella costume. And at one point in one take, there's a black tag that you can see on the Grisabella costume. And mm-hmm. I think it's a blanket.
Mm.
I think they've like turned a blanket into a costume and then somebody forgot to cut the tag out. And then they realized in playback that there was a tag and then they cut it out and then they continued filming.
I mean, I was more just distracted by the fact that she was clearly CGI'd into the scene.
Yeah. I don't think she met anybody.
Well, so today, this morning, before we recorded, I did some research. I rewatched certain clips of it and then like read some articles and some reviews and whatnot, and then did some digging on some cast members. And there was a small article that was released like when the movie came out, where like one of the child actors was like, Dolly Parton saved my life on set.
Yeah.
And I'm like, I don't buy that story because I don't buy that she was actually there. The entire thing feels like she shot her stuff in her living room at Dollywood and they put her on.
For sure. There were a lot of scenes where she like appeared as a ghost to Christine Baranski and very obviously was not in the room with her, near her, around her, in the same time zone as her, anything.
Okay. So let's give some background before we delve into the movie frame by frame.
Frame by frame.
My frame, because every frame is a masterpiece. So this is available on Netflix, guys. It's Dolly Parton's Christmas on the Square. Teleplay by Maria S. Schlatter, I think is how you say her name. Who knows? Music and lyrics by Dolly Parton, directed and choreographed by Debbie Allen.
Wow. Okay. I will be honest. I didn't know that.
You didn't know that Debbie Allen directed and choreographed it?
No.
Does it make more sense now?
No.
How can that? Anytime there's dancing, it's just like the most dancing, which is
there's the most Allen. Dancing. There are a lot of shots of like men being lifted by other men, which is like a full crotch shot of the being lifted man.
Oh yeah, I will say something about this movie that I appreciate is every time it gets a little Jesus-y Midwestern townie, Debbie Allen then cuts to the gay men ensemble, where they just like spread their legs open, ready for all 7 inches of the Christmas spirit.
1,000,000%. And I actually do appreciate that. And also every like group scene is like a couple people in the front doing like a little box step, but then like you kind of let your eyes drift to the back and it's just like a mishmash of tumbling.
Yeah. Tumbling, cooter slams, high kicks.
1,000,000%.
Yes. And then you've got Jennifer Lewis and the character actors doing a box step in the front. So the plot, according to the movie's press release, a rich and nasty woman, Regina Fuller, returns to her small hometown after her father's death to evict everyone and sell the land to a mall developer right before Christmas. However, after listening to stories of the local townsfolk reconnecting with an old love and accepting the guidance of an actual angel, Regina starts to have a change of heart. This is the story about family, love, and how a small town's Christmas spirit can warm even the coldest of hearts. Netflix has it listed under heartfelt, inspiring, and campy. All of which I say are accurate.
Yeah, I would say all those are true.
My personal favorite, I also read some like official reviews, and I recommend reading the New York Times review for it because this is the guy who like, he knows what's up. He loved this movie in the same way that I loved this movie, which is, he says, it's bad. The sort of bad that knows what it is. Campy rather than camp. Campy is camp with a diploma and a martini, and Christmas on the Square is a drunk.
So well put.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I think that should win a Pulitzer Prize.
That's why he
writes Christmas on the Square, by the way, just that review.
No, Christmas on the Square deserves a Nobel Peace Prize. Thank you very
much. Yeah, because what that plot summary doesn't tell you is that also it threatens to be a sort of Scrooge story where it's like, we're going to take you around to see how you've ruined everybody's lives. But then it abandons that. But then she finds out she had a kid. But then, so it's every
plot. She finds out she had a kid.
Well, you know what I mean. Like, I know. It's every plot of every movie that you've ever seen. So I would say that if you like plots of movies, you will find something you like in this movie because it has it all.
If you like plots of movies.
If you've ever seen a movie and liked it, you will find some thread of this movie you connect to.
Yes, it's definitely like a combination of A Christmas Carol, It's a Wonderful Life, elements of Bright Star, you know?
That I was going to say Bright Star too, because it's like, yeah, it's got everything. So if you like any of those a lot, don't watch this movie because it's only about 5 to 7% of any of those. Mm-hmm. But if you are just hungry for, because like there's a part where they're like, what would life be like if you weren't here? And you're like, oh, it's going to be like A Wonderful Life. And then they're like, just kidding. It's really actually not. But you are going to find an artifact from your dad who you loved and find out who your son was. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's a little bit of everything.
It is a little bit of everything. There's also, there's also like a possible like brain tumor cancer subplot that like also doesn't go anywhere because this movie loves to start things and then never finish them.
Yeah, it's a lot of questions and no answers.
You know what this movie is? This movie is a straight man during sex because it wants to start the sex but doesn't care if you finish.
I was gonna say I think it's like and this is a high compliment, it's like an art house film where it's more about the experience than what you think of it, because it's almost incomprehensible to put together, but it's just a series of images. It's like the Koyaanisqatsi of the Dolly Parton oeuvre.
There are times when I feel like Dolly and Debbie Allen knew 100% what kind of movie they were making, like understood that this was what it was supposed to be. Then there are times when I'm like, did they think this was going to be like the one?
It only approaches that like once or twice, which is what kind of saves it, because it never takes itself too seriously. There are a couple moments that like you can tell that they were like, you know, this could really compel an audience. And the answer is no, it doesn't, and it doesn't and won't. Because at this point, they're too drunk to know what's going on. But like, it's fine. It doesn't indulge too much.
I say, Allie, we just dive right into this movie from the get-go. The opening, shall we?
Yeah.
So also, first of all, there's no official soundtrack for this movie, nor does IMDb list the song titles. So as I was rewatching parts of it, taking notes, I'm giving what I think are the song titles.
Sure. And you know what? I bet you're right.
Fingers crossed. The opening number is called either Christmas Is or Christmas on the Square.
Okay. Good guesses.
Good guesses. And it opens on a soundstage. The whole movie is on a soundstage.
1,000,000%.
It's an opening number where, as you said, we meet every single major character of the film and basically what their one personality trait is.
Yes.
So we have Dolly, who's, as far as we know, homeless and glowy. And she has a box that says change on it. And that word's important because it's used a lot for double meaning.
Yeah. She just keeps coming up to people and asking, change?
Mm-hmm. Change.
Much Annie, like in A New Brain. But
yes. Any change. Yes. All she's asking for is change. We are introduced to the entire town, dancing people, singing people, little children, dogs in a truck or trolley, whatever the fuck it is. We meet the town pastor, Father Christian, played by Josh Segarra, his wife, and what's her name? I wrote it down. Jenna. Because he's only referring to her as like my love, darling, my dear. And no one refers to her by her first name, I'm pretty sure. So
that's
I have to go.
That's very true. Why does she not? Yeah, that's true.
And I'll get to her costume in a second, because this is actually a question I have about the town in general, of like where they are and exactly what the weather is.
No one will ever know.
No, because it's supposed to be cold enough that there's snow on the ground. And some people are bundled up wearing thermal underwear. And yet there are women in the town bare-legged in stilettos with flowy silk skirts and jean jackets and nothing else.
Or how about when Christine Baranski was standing on her balcony when in a robe and a hair towel?
Yeah.
I was like you're cold.
Yeah, how are you? Well, maybe that was like supposed to be a metaphor that like she's so cold-hearted that not even that could give her pneumonia.
She can never be cold.
She can never be cold. She's Christine Baranski. We also meet Christine Baranski's childhood friend, Margeline, played by
Margeline.
Played by Ms. Jennifer Lewis.
Margeline is a cat that was cut from Cats, like with certainty.
She was supposed to sing Macavity, but she just kept like improvising the melody line, and Andrew Lloyd-Webber was like, no. So she got cut.
Yeah, she got cut.
Margeline owns the beauty salon with a bunch of voguing gays.
Yep, it's just her and a bunch of gays, which I maybe that is accurate representation. I'm not sure.
I mean, it is the most diverse Midwestern town I can think of.
Yes. And I do, my favorite line of dialogue in the whole movie is at the beginning of it, where Jennifer Lewis, she owns her own beauty, what's the word I'm looking for? Salon? Her own beauty salon? Because it seems that they seem to do like makeup, hair, all this shit.
Yes.
But she also does private appointments on request, especially for Christine Baranski, mm-hmm. who, again, seems not to live in this town, but when she does live in town, Margeline does her hair. Mm. And the best line of dialogue in the movie is when Christine Baranski goes, "Now, Margeline, I know that we've been best friends and we grew up here together, but," and it's like, okay, phenomenal. I'm obsessed. Like,
more than half of the dialogue of this movie is pure exposition. Because 100%. My other personal favorite line of dialogue is also in the opening number, where we meet the pastor and his wife, and he says to her,
"To the best Christmas gift we've ever given each other.
Getting fertility treatments is better than anything that comes in paper."
Wow. I almost kind of forgot that one.
Oh, the moment it was uttered, I said, I'm going to love this movie to the day I die. We're getting so sidetracked.
We're still not even in the first
movie. I know, we're not even past the opening number. So yes, the whole point of the opening number is we're introduced to everybody. Regina is doling out eviction notices to everybody because her father owned the town. Now he's dead. And we know that he's dead because when she goes to meet the pastor and his wife, they say to her,
"Regina Fuller, I haven't seen you since your father's funeral 6 months ago."
"We miss him so much. How have you been?"
Oh my God, another incredible piece of dialogue.
Absolutely. And then her assistant Felicity is singing "I'm Sorry" in counterpoint to everyone the entire time. So you have like, gotta get out of this town, so sorry. Christmas on the square, so sorry. It's wonderful.
Holly jolly Christmas, I'm so sorry. Jokes everywhere.
I'm so sorry.
Slaves and skates and chisel space, so more than enough to share.
Apologize.
It's mines and such good times, it's Christmas on the square.
Whether it's in the open number or directly after, at some point her doctor's like, "We really should talk about your test results." And she's like, "I am too busy to talk about my test results." Which is crazy, even for a evil movie protagonist, for somebody to be like, "I don't know, I just, I guess it's inappropriate for me to say here, but we did see some shadows on your brain." And her to be like, "I'm too busy for this."
I mean, if 2020 has taught us anything, there are people like that. Where it's like, so you're like, you need a ventilator. You're about to die. And it's like, no, I want to get my hair cut. And that's what ends up happening.
Because that is actually what ends up happening, is she literally is like, "I have to go home. I'm late." And you're like, wow, for what? I guess I would assume a meeting with the mall corporation. And the answer is no, it's for getting your hair done by Jennifer Lewis.
Yes. Or like there are a couple times where she just comes back to her father's house just to come back, if that makes sense. Like she doesn't come back to like do anything. She's got this big contract for the Cheetah Mall that she has to sign in order to like officially sell the town. She keeps putting it off, but like every time she's like, "I have to go back. I'm too busy." She goes back and like she doesn't do shit. Point is, she serves the eviction notices. Town decides they're going to organize a resistance. A resistance do what? We never actually know. They just keep talking about the resistance. I also love, there's a great visual gag where like they make this giant sign saying "Resist Regina" for the town church. And they're like, "I think she can see that from space." And it is 3 feet wide.
It is so small.
It's the smallest sign in the land. There are men at the Eagle that have had arms longer up their asshole than that sign is wide.
Is truly the size of like a piece of art you could buy off like Society 6 and have shipped to your house.
Yes.
Flat rate. It's like not going to do anything.
Also,
they never ever say like what the resistance will be or if they're planning on like buying back the town or staging a protest or getting press involved. Again, it is a question with no answer.
Exactly. They do have a scene and a song where they like brainstorm, but again, nothing comes of it.
Yeah, and the brainstorming is like, should we kill her?
Yeah.
It's never like, oh, what if we got like the press involved and like shamed her publicly? It's literally like, we should smack her upside the head. We should kick her in the shins.
Maybe we'll singe her hair, or we'll trap her like a bear.
Maybe we'll just rough her up a little.
It's You're a Mean One, Mr. Grinch meets Snuff That Girl from Urinetown. That's what
Wow. That was actually really apt.
Thank you. First of all, how dare you? Always apt, you motherfucker.
This is really good, okay?
Thank you. I appreciate the compliment. And I will take my hand and reach through this computer screen and grab you by the hair for that backhanded compliment.
No, it was good.
So, yes, Town organizes a resistance, or thinks they're going to end the song, Wickedest Witch of the Middle.
Is the middle like Middle America? Because that's another question we never answer.
Yes, it's supposed to be like the Midwest, because Wicked Witch of the West, Wicked Witch of the Midwest, so she's the Wicked Witch of the Middle.
I mean, it's not good.
It's not good.
But the entire time we kept being like, is the town called the Middle? And it's not. And then we were like, oh, is it a play on like middle of nowhere? And it's not. It truly is just saying the middle of the country.
Yes. A Fullerville somewhere, United States.
Correct.
There's also a song which we recognize for a hot second, but I just want to give it 30 seconds more spotlight, where Jennifer Lewis comes to do Christine Baranski's hair and facial treatment, where she also gives a bit of expositional dialogue talking about Carl, played by Treat Williams, who owns the like Five and Dime store or whatever.
Yes.
And a general store. And Christine Baranski's like, it's just business giving him this eviction notice. And Jennifer Lewis goes,
yeah, well, it wasn't just business the first time. High school sweetheart sneaking behind your daddy's back.
Yep. And then she sings a song to Christine Baranski that I'm pretty sure is called Feel Good About It. Or it's called Jennifer Lewis Treats Haircuts Like a Weed Whacker.
Yeah, she like just absolutely goes to town on Christine Baranski's head. And by that, I mean wig. And also, they've kind of done Christine Baranski dirty on this wig that she's wearing in this movie. It is sort of like too far forward on her head with wispy bangs.
It's a good color. It's a good color on her, but it is a weird shape.
It's a weird shape, and I've seen her wear better wigs.
It's like a helmet with bangs, essentially.
Yeah, and like the bangs are like small, and it's kind of making her forehead very small, too. Mm-hmm. Not my favorite of the Christine Baranski wigs. If you're a Baranski head such as I am, you've seen her wear better wigs.
How can you not? Be still my beating vagina.
Be still my beating vagina is one of the best lines ever in any movie ever.
Absolutely. Like, sit the fuck down, All About Eve. That movie, Mamma Mia 2, here we go again, has just annihilated you for dialogue.
I think Mamma Mia 2 is better than Mamma Mia 1, but we can talk about it on another one.
That's another day.
Hey, won't you let me in? Let your hair.
Jennifer Lewis's song, I can't tell if the melody is weird or if she's just sharp the whole time. Do you know what I mean? Because like I could never tell if she was hitting the note or not. I was like, is this just a weirdly written song, or is Jennifer Lewis sharp for this?
I don't know. The truth is the song went in one ear and out the other. It has no discernible melody. It didn't really have an A section or a B section. It sort of had an A, B, C, D, E, F, and then G section, and then it was over.
Yes.
But when I try to remember the song, like if I really try to remember how it goes, I can only hear in my head that song that they use in All That Jazz, which is like, you gotta change your way today. That's all I can really hear in my head. It's basically that song, but not as good.
It's that song on cocaine with poppers, because it has some of my favorite lyrics in the movie, where she goes, oh, Regini, playing Queenie, they say you are such a meanie, I've known you since we were teeny.
Incredible.
Then, oh, Regina, I have seen a lot of change in your demeanor, scheming is your new arena. And then Christine Baranski, faggot that she is, replies,
I don't need exfoliant for this face off.
Oh my God, I forgot about that too.
You can also see every now and then, you can tell that Christine Baranski is trying really hard not to crack.
Just so crazy.
It's so crazy. And every
time she's just like smacking her head with a towel a lot.
And like cutting her hair like it's a bush. And then like she's trying to tease it, but it literally just, I don't know what it looks like. How is she teasing it? It looks like she becomes a tumbleweed.
Yeah, it's certainly no way any human has ever done hair. Certainly not a human who does it ostensibly professionally and like has for upwards of 30 years or something like that. Like
supposedly is a professional.
Yeah. It's well, you know, again, yes. Worth seeing.
So yes, this is all to say, we see the resistance. We also see Regina go to her high school sweetheart, Treat Williams, who owns the general store with basically just dolls. It's like not even a general store.
It's not a general store. It's like a antiques roadshow haunted doll repository.
Yes. And he says something that I really hate because everyone says it all the time in this movie, but they say it all the time in general, where they're like, what happened to you, Regina? What happened to the memories I had of you? What happened to this and that? And part of me is like, yes, she's a raging bitch. But also I'm like, time goes by and people change. I'm not tethered to your memory of me.
Yes. And they also like never specify what she used to be like besides, I guess, nice.
Nicer, yeah.
I do think is kind of BS, like in terms of like, even like, if you think about like Scrooge, right? Mm-hmm. Which obviously is it's not a fair comparison because that's like a really good piece of fiction. But like, you know, like when they go back and show him like being generous with his coworkers or blah, 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 blah. And you're like, oh, there are specific ways in which this man changed. He didn't just like become a bitch one day. And everyone was like, oh yeah, by the way, Scrooge is a bitch.
Yeah.
Like, and that's kind of what they do in this one. There's like, Regina, now you're a bitch and you used to not be a bitch. And it's like, oh, I wish we could know. I wish we had any idea of who she was before she was ostensibly a bitch.
And Christmas Carol is interesting. So Christmas Carol also deals with a much narrower storytelling frame. Like, it really is just about Scrooge, and like the secondary characters are all in relation to his journey. So you learn about what's going on with them in relation to him. Whereas Christmas on the Square is trying to give like life to everyone outside of Christine Baranski. And
when you say everyone, you mean everyone.
Everyone.
Every single person in this movie is a protagonist and is the protagonist.
Everyone gets their moment to shine. Oh, ooh, 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 ooh. Ooh, ooh. I cannot believe that I forgot to mention this when we discussed the opening number. Truly, you could make a whole episode about the opening number. It's 5 minutes of just jam-packed of everything.
Yes.
There's one character who will pop up again in Wickedest Witch of the Middle, who she's just an older woman. And she's always like, maybe we should rough her up a little. And she's in the opening number and she's like, ooh, how romantic. Happy holidays. And her character name is literally Granny Hoover.
Incredible.
Incredible. But also there's a little boy, so they have a line in the opening number about like snowball fights, and this little boy throws a snowball and another one gets thrown back at him and it hits him in the face. And in post, I guess, is it looping when like they have someone like dub voiceover stuff?
Oh, ADR,
yes. So they do ADR with this boy where he gets hit in the face and you hear him go, ow, my eye.
Protagonist.
He's a protagonist because we needed to know how he felt about getting hit in the face.
I'm like, obsessed with that.
The movie is so concerned with making sure everyone has a voice that the whole thing is like, you just get so thrown. You're like, but wait, what happened to his eye? Wait, what happened to her? What happened to her and him?
I actually like, I think that's like an amazing genre of film. It's sort of like the Magnolia of Christmas movies where you're just like, oh yeah, don't worry. We're going to come back to them and they're going to have a breakdown. Don't you worry.
But they're like, Magnolia was too long, so we're going to do what Magnolia did in about half the time.
1,000,000%. All you're going to get is, ow, my eye, but you'll get a sense of an inner life there.
I'm loving this. I've never made a better decision in my life than to talk about this movie with you.
I'm so glad. I feel like I have nothing like worthwhile to say because it is like one of those things that like it just has to be seen.
Yeah,
but and like you will either love it or hate it. There's like simply no in between.
Sure, there's no in between, but also I don't know. I have now officially watched this movie 2.5 times, and
incredible.
I intend to watch it for a 3.5 time on Christmas Day. So I have a lot of resources at my fingertips right now, but also like immediate reactions are sometimes enough for this movie. Like, you don't need someone to like dissect everything. It's nice sometimes, but you also can just like have a lot to say off of just an immediate reaction, you know?
Yes. And so I want to talk about one of my strongest reactions in this film, which was to assistant, executive assistant, chauffeur.
Felicity.
I don't know what her, Felicity, who I immediately recognized from Soy Vegan Dance.
Okay, that, so yes, I did not know that's what she was from. I had seen her in one episode of You're the Worst, and I remember, and I saw her in this being like, oh, look at her, she's getting her moment. And then Dolly Parton sings a song to her slash with her where they end up in a dance studio for 40 seconds due to Christmas magic. And I'm like, okay, I guess they wanted to show that she dances. And then when I found out she used to be on So You Think You Can Dance, I was like, oh, it's fan appeasement.
Yes, exactly. And also, like, the dancing has nothing to do with anything. And also, for a movie that has a lot of dancing that's, like, in the plot, it's weird that her dancing all took place out of the plot.
Yeah.
But whatever. So anyway, they were clearly putting a lot of time on her. And you were like, what is going to happen with her and this assistant? And again, because it's, like, everyone keeps being like, she's such a Scrooge, that Regina. You keep being like, I wonder if she's, like, the Bob Cratchit. And, like, we have to figure out, like, what's going on in her life. And the minute that Regina's like, oh, I can't believe I've never asked you about your life. Mm-hmm. And she's like, oh, well, I'm only here working for you because my dad's dying and I need money for his treatment. And then she's like, I'll pay for the treatment. Nope, she's also an angel, but she's an angel in training. Mm-hmm. And, like, I mean, like, these are the kind of revelations that you can't buy.
Yes.
You gotta, like, I was astounded.
So, like, Dolly's character is, like, omnipresent. She's always popping up. She's always asking for change. And then she shows up in Christine Baranski's apartment after Christine Baranski's been told she might have a brain tumor. And she shows up in her Dolly finest, like, white glittery outfit, sitting on a floating cloud the entire time.
Loved that.
Legs crossed like the fucking lady that she is. And she sings about, like, everyone needs an angel. And then she sings about Christine Baranski's dad, who used to own the town but died 6 months prior. She's like, your daddy used to love having lamplighters. He loved lamps because he would read about lamps. And everybody needs to shine their lamp. And I'm like, that's a very long road to get to our point. But, yeah, so you find out that Felicity is an angel in training because Dolly shows up in Christine Baranski's kitchen talking to Felicity. And she's like, the whole reason for being an angel in training is you got to learn how to be an angel. And
yeah, and then it doesn't make sense that, like, why are the two of them assigned to her case? Because it's like, Dolly's clearly on the case, but Felicity's also on the case.
Yeah, it's very muddled because I think what it's supposed to be is that Dolly is on Felicity's case. Like, Dolly is training Felicity, and Felicity is on Christine Baranski's case. Because there's a moment in the opening when Dolly asks – there are two moments, actually, in the opening. There's one where Dolly asks Christine Baranski for change. And Christine Baranski walks away, and Felicity says to her, sorry, no change. And when I first watched it, I thought it was her, like, apologizing to the homeless woman. And upon rewatching it, I'm like, I guess that's, like, her update for Dolly. Like,
right, like, oh, no change yet.
Like, yeah, because the whole point is that Felicity is supposed to get Christine Baranski to change her heart and her mind.
And she does not do
she
that.
She does not do it. Christine does it on her fucking own.
And also kind of Dolly, but, like, so anyway, there was no reason for this woman to be an angel, but she is.
She gets promoted anyway because she's a pretty thin woman. I want to get to this moment because it's legitimately my favorite scene in the movie. And I mean this, like, in every way, shape, and form. Regina shows up to the resistance and yells at them all for hating her.
The deadline to be out of your homes is now Christmas Eve.
And they sing a song about how they're going to work together, but they never actually do. And Christine goes into a bar that is bartended by a little 7-year-old girl named Violet.
Yes, who pours herself a drink.
She pours Christine whiskey and pours herself chocolate milk.
Correct. And Christine Baranski, or the character of Regina, but I think by extension Christine Baranski,
yes,
is enamored by this little girl and her, like, hardness towards life. Mm-hmm. Like, they're like, you said it, sister. Men suck. Or, like, whatever. And yes. I really do mean this, and I'm not being facetious in any way, shape, or form when I say it was my favorite scene, too, because I think I could tell how much fun Christine Baranski was having.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was like, I, too, now am having fun watching this, like, little girl be like, lady, I grew up in a bar. What do you think? I don't know my crayons. And you're like, damn, bitch, I love you.
I don't know my crayons. Yeah, because the girl's written in a way where she's, like, not super street tough Annie, because also, like, the town she grew up in is literally the most wholesome of towns.
Yes, and, like, she grew up in a bar, but the bar is basically, like, appointed like a bed and breakfast. It's not like a rough and tumble pub. It's like,
yeah,
it's like a nice, it's like a, like, tchotchkes on the wall.
Yeah, like, yeah, there are no drunks who are just, like, vomiting on the bar, bachelorette parties, peeing on the floor. It's wholesome town folk who just, like, want to get a little drink. So she just serves. Right. And also, like, I will say, I would have loved it if Christine Baranski was like, I'll have a sex on the beach, and Violet knew exactly how to make it.
I genuinely think there's like rules against like, we can't see like a child mix a drink on screen. But like, I think that was the intention of that. Like, I can see in my head an alternate version of that scene where she mixes her a mojito and like crushes the mint and like,
yeah,
it's like a really great bartender.
Is that really a rule that you can't show a child?
No, I am assuming that if it's like going to get a rating of a PG or something like that, you can't like watch like a child like engage with alcohol in a meaningful way or something.
Yes. I mean, while she is a wonderful bartender, she also doesn't do that much as a bartender. She literally pours alcohol into a glass. Just
also,
ice in there.
She pours her, and I mean this, more whiskey than anyone's ever poured another human. Like, if a healthy pours two fingers, it's like a fist and a half. Like, it's so wild.
Allie, that's what I mean when I say that both It's a Wonderful Life and gay porn is on in the background.
Yes, yes. And then they like talk about like how tough life can be in a sort of like not serious way where they're just like, yeah, you know, Christmas means nothing to me. It's just another day. And Christine's like, yeah, I know. And then we find out that the little girl is actually jaded and bitter because her mom died. And she's guilty about it because she had a fever and her mom went out to get medicine and died?
Yeah, so this is where the true turning for Christine Baranski starts, because we learn that Christine Baranski's so the whole like main gist is how like Christine Baranski technically owns the land that the town is on, and she inherited it from her father, but I guess like he had been sick for a few years before he actually died, and so when that happened, she was in charge of like running the town, which I don't know if that's actually how towns work, where like you're the like you own the land, so you basically get to say what happens in the town.
I don't think that that's ever been true or ever will be true. Like, yeah, I don't think that like if you decide to sell a piece of property, you can just be like, oh, and also by the way, knock everything down.
Yeah, it's one of those like Scrooge McDuck, like, well,
I swim in a pile of money.
Yes,
so I can do what I want.
Don't worry about it. But the essential idea is like, she is responsible for the town for a few years, and she raises rents and she like evicts businesses that aren't doing well, which like kind of makes sense. It is like a very warped version of the truth in terms of like land ownership. But the idea is that she wouldn't allow people who were behind on their rent to continue with their businesses. So the town pharmacy had to close. And thus Violet's mom, when she was a baby, had to drive 20 miles to the next town to get her medicine, and drove back and like in a storm got swept up in the wash and drowned.
Okay.
And
see,
Violet's-
you know, I feel like it would have been such an easy fix. I guess it would have been more evil, which is probably why they didn't do it. But like, it would have been so much easier for them to be like, yeah, the lady who like was in charge of this town didn't give a shit about us, and there was like a derelict bridge that we always wanted to have like fixed or whatever, and then like one night my mom was driving back on the bridge and like the bridge collapsed, and then there was like a lawsuit, but she like crushed it. So
well, I think if they wanted
we don't have money and my mom's dead,
I think they wanted to do it so Christine Baranski wasn't like directly responsible for it, because that's right. The whole thing was Violet also doesn't know that she's talking to Christine Baranski. She thinks she's talking to like some random woman. She doesn't know that she's talking to the woman who's running the town out. And Violet says, like, my dad blames her. I don't blame her, because if I hadn't gotten sick, my mom would still be alive. And that's what breaks Christine Baranski.
Yeah, and she's like, oh, no, don't say that. And then it gets interrupted.
She doesn't even say don't say that. All she says is no. She says no six times. She goes, no, no, no. It reminds me of Skylar telling her sister on Breaking Bad to shut up.
Oh, my God, I love that.
What's her name? Christine? Claire?
Skylar.
No, Skylar's sister, though. What's her name?
Ooh, Marie.
Marie. She's literally like that's why I thought she was Claire. Marie Claire.
Marie Claire.
Like, Marie, just shut up. Just shut up. Shut up. Shut up. For me, that's Christine Baranski telling Violet, no. No.
I loved
that. No. It's great. Flash forward, Christine Baranski goes to get a CAT scan, which ends up being that her tumor's not anything. But while she's getting the CAT scan, we reminisce and find out what made Christine Baranski Christine Baranski. And unlike Ebenezer Scrooge, where you find out it was like a series of things over his life, like being orphaned and like going to a workhouse and then like growing up poor and working his way up, like little things contributed to him becoming who he is. Christine Baranski, we find out, dated Treat Williams back in the day, and at a Christmas dance, saw him with a ring to another girl, which of course, like any Tom, Dick, or Harry could tell you, he was showing the ring he was going to be giving her to a friend. Because it's supposed to be circumstantial. You see him silently give a ring to another girl, and she,
and
like,
she's like, oh, wow. And he's like not down on one knee or anything either. So it's
and
like
they don't
pretty
kiss.
Obvious.
It's like, it's a very, yeah.
It's very obvious.
Yes. And she's like, well, I was so hurt that I danced with the first guy that paid attention to me. And it's a guy who's very clearly like 30 years old.
Yeah.
Classic like 70s. What's the word I'm looking for? Sleazeball, like goatee, chest hair, like butt shirt unbuttoned down to his dick. And he's, and he like walks up to like young Christina Baranski and be like, you, I'm going to get you pregnant tonight, which he does.
Which he does.
And Christine Baranski's dad's like, we must give away the baby. And then she's like, I hate you for giving away the baby. Which then leads us to Christine gets out of the hospital where she's like, I don't want to say like she comes to peace with her past, because she finds out that her dad like felt bad about giving away the baby. But she walks out and you find out that Violet and her dad got into a car crash and Violet needs brain surgery. So she
not only that, but again, another amazing line of dialogue.
We were on our way to the cemetery so she could leave flowers on her mother's grave like every Christmas.
And on the way back, my car skidded off the road. And
he doesn't
like,
even
okay.
say that. He says the Christmas thing. Violet's dad says the Christmas thing. And he goes, it's all my fault. And then all of a sudden, Father Christian and his wife show up. And they go, no, we saw it all. That man ran into you and drove away. They might have all been like, and it was 9:36 p.m.
on these
coordinates.
Just them being like, well, we were going and putting flowers on my mother's grave like we do every single Christmas. And it's like, and the reaction to that is like, everyone's like, well, yeah, duh. Like everyone does. Like that's
the entire town. The entire town within 5 seconds knows that Violet has been hit, because as soon as Christine Baranski finds out and they bring her into the hospital, Jennifer Lewis shows up with like 12 people from the town and they go, what's the latest? And Christine Baranski goes, she just went into the hospital. I'm like, oh my God, this town is faster than Twitter.
It's amazing. But also, so Christine Baranski is like, I have a friend who's the best pediatric brain surgeon in the world. Helicopter him in. And
it's
then her assistant's like, yeah, sure, I will.
It's even
and
more again, generic than that. She's like, find out who the best pediatric neurosurgeon is in the country and helicopter them
and
in.
And get him.
And get him or her. And within, all it takes is one musical number where Violet's dad sings a song to her about like, if you need to go to your mom in heaven, do it. Which like, granted, I know we're shitting on this movie. That gentleman sang like an angel.
Oh my God, he sang like an angel.
And cried like a goddamn dream.
Yeah, no, that was a star. That was a star-making performance. However, think it was so funny that they were like, the last doctor we saw was like, she's in stable condition, but maybe not for long. Which was like, I think a pretty okay generic dialogue thing. And then I thought it was so funny that the rest of his song was like, baby, if you gotta die, go ahead and die. I thought it was gonna end with him putting a pillow over her face. Like, I was like, stop, she's okay. Like, it was a weird, I thought it was a weird thing to focus on after getting such good news to be like, for them to be like, she's in stable condition. We just need somebody to look at her brain. And for me, and then like for you as an audience member to like take that as like, okay, well, I assume she'll be okay. I hope. And for his whole song to be like, if you have to go.
they might as well have been like, she's improving, but we don't know how quickly her recovery is going to be. And like,
and he kills her. Like,
you want to fucking die, just do it.
That is how I felt when I was watching. Like, I was joking about it with my friends of just being like, he is going to take that pillow and he's going to smother her to death.
Because they all have to pack up because they all have to leave the next day.
Oh my God.
By the end of his number, the neurosurgeon is there and he's like, you're from 100 miles away. And she's like, well, you have a guardian angel. And I'm like, I can't tell you what's over 100 miles away from New York City.
I would never know. But I guess they live in a town where the nearest pharmacy is 20 miles away. So I guess you...
Yeah.
I guess if you like don't have anything near you, you are aware of how far things away are.
I mean, I guess if you live in a state where most spouses are cousins, like there are maybe 6 towns in the entire state.
In a movie where Dolly Parton could just be an angel and save this girl from her brain damage, instead Christine Baranski has to fly a real human in to prove that she's a good human. But it's like
both things happen though. Christine Baranski flies in a real human to fix Violet's brain. And then they're like, now if only Violet would wake up. I'm like, bitch, she just came out of surgery 5 minutes ago. Right. Give her a second.
And then Dolly Parton comes and shakes her awake with magic and is like,
and she
up,
wakes
bitch.
Up. Yes. Yeah. And then eventually Violet is able to dance in the town square the same evening that she had
brain
surgery.
1,000,000%.
The way that Josh Segarra is like, good news, Violet's recovering. Now she would just wake up. And I shouted on my screen. I said, give her a minute.
Like, she can't. Like, they're like, wake up now. We have to move tomorrow.
Her brain is swollen. They don't care. They don't get... Well, yeah, they do have to leave. But so then... So Felicity is, like, kind of helping Christine Baranski see the light of her ways because, like, life is getting Christine Baranski to change her heart, but now, like, Felicity's trying to help her change her mind to not sell the town. But then, like, eventually just abandons Christine Baranski, like, goes to the town meeting anyway while Christine Baranski, like, goes on her own. It's all very crazy.
It's, like, one of those things where, like, Dolly Parton was like, hey, you have to give her time. And she's like, we don't have any time. And so she, like, forces her to go, like, have a reconciliation with her
high school love.
And Dolly Parton doesn't think it's going to be a good idea, but that doesn't make sense because she's, I guess, omnipotent and should know that it's a fine idea, but whatever. Felicity has to be like, no, trust me, it's a good idea. And so then she abandons her over there and then they make up and, you know, gives her an opportunity to go dance in the next dance number.
Yes. And then Christine Baranski's in her home and her father like has this lamp head.
Which is a prototype, by the way.
A prototype, yes, a prototype for the lamps that he wanted in the town.
Now, you might be asking, is it anything other than just a regular old gas lamp? And the answer is no, which is probably why the prototype didn't go anywhere, because I think he just reinvented a gas lamp.
That's, again, classic white man, just like reinvented something that already existed.
Yeah, they're like, no, sir, you didn't make that. That's a candle. And he's like, I made this.
Have you ever seen the movie To Die For with Nicole Kidman?
I don't think so.
Oh, first of all, get into it. So it's a 90s movie, and it's like, really the movie that kind of made Nicole Kidman separate from Tom Cruise. And everyone was like, oh, she's an actress. Because at that time she was just like known as Mrs. Tom Cruise. But it's a black comedy that she stars in as this woman who desperately wants to become like a news anchor. She wants to be on TV. She wants to be famous. And essentially seduces teenage Joaquin Phoenix and Casey Affleck to murder her husband, Matt Dillon.
Oh, I'm obsessed with this plot. Oh, right?
Definitely watch it. It's amazing. Holland Taylor's also in it. Huh. Bunch of people. Dan Hedaya. Part of the humor is how like Nicole Kidman's character is just so vapid. And half of the movie's done sort of like as a mockumentary style. People are being interviewed about Nicole Kidman and like flashes back and forth of present day and past. But so I bring it up because we mentioned Christine Baranski's father and the prototype of the lamp. And he's like, look at this thing I made. When they're talking about Nicole Kidman's wedding to Matt Dillon, Matt Dillon's sister, who like very clearly hates Nicole Kidman's character, they're interviewing her. She was like, Larry was really proud of, I already forgot Nicole Kidman's character's name. Suzanne. She's like, he was very proud of Suzanne because she designed the wedding rings. And she goes, you want to know what they looked like? They were round and gold.
That is this.
Yeah,
he,
it's very
so
that.
He invented a lamp, but I guess the lamp also had a secret compartment
with a Bible
a diary in it. Oh, it was a Bible.
It was a fucking Bible.
And the Bible was annotated like a diary.
Yes, with like the family history, to which Christine Baranski says, and it's written in a Bible, so it must be true.
That is astounding.
I was like, those are loaded, loaded words.
That is an astounding piece of knowledge.
Yes. So Christine Baranski finds this like secret compartment to the lamp prototype, to which I'm like, does every lamp in town have a secret compartment?
I don't know. They never specify if that's what's the prototype or not.
This movie became Pretty Little Liars all of a sudden.
Like, I mean, this is like the bright star section of the movie, which is that like, surprise, your son's been here all along.
Yes. He's alive and he's in your life.
Now, I will say we all made a called shot that it was going to be a daughter and it was the wife of the pastor because she seemed to not really have any major purpose in the movie and we felt kind of bad for her. And so we were
not being able to get pregnant.
Correct. Which we thought was not a personality trait, which spoiler alert, it isn't. So we were like, oh, she's going to be the lost daughter. Turns out she's not.
I think we're thinking about this a little too much. And then when it ended up being Father Christian, I called it only because it seemed like such an obvious choice, but also like there was no indication ever that like he was an orphan, that he didn't know his parentage.
I would have thought at the very least, because it would have been easy for him to like in a sermon have been like, you know, like you have to be with our families at this difficult time and a family can be anything. It doesn't have to be your biological parents. I don't know mine. Mm-hmm. It would have been so easy. And so like I naively thought it couldn't be him because he'd never talked about not having parents. So that's pretty naive of me to think that this movie had any consideration towards like anything like that and script revisions. So that's on me.
It all it needed was like two lines where she's like, what if I can't have kids? Like, would that be the worst thing? He's like, we'll make our own family. He's like, I guess I really want a family because I never really had one growing up. So I want to make my own. Like, yeah. All it takes is that.
It would have been so easy, but they didn't. And so, of course, I was like, oh, I mean, if it was him, he would have said something.
Exactly.
Which is a silly thing for me to say.
I think if it were his wife who was the kid instead, that would also be a little more problematic because it's like, oh, now she can get pregnant because now she knows where she came from. Like, oh, women can't get pregnant unless they know where they came from.
Okay. Well, Matt, obviously, the real moral of the movie is women can't get pregnant unless Dolly Parton impregnates you.
Yes. So let's discuss this because this is the ultimate moment of the movie. And I don't know if you know this, but Trixie and Katya just released a video of them watching Christmas on the Square.
Were they obsessed with this moment?
This moment didn't show up. They didn't show
that's
it to them.
That's insane.
It's
because it is, I think, the crown jewel of the movie.
So there's a song towards, like, in the third act of the movie where Dolly is wandering all over the town. She's singing in the gazebo, which, by the way, in the opening number, again, coming back to the opening number, there's an aerialist in the gazebo of the opening number. It's phenomenal. So Dolly's in the gazebo and everyone around the town is, like, holding candles, I guess, like, to hold vigil for Violet. And
they just really want this bitch to wake up.
They really do. They're like, bitch, we gotta get out of here tomorrow. Wake the fuck up. Which then I'm also like, what happened to the resistance? Then, so Dolly goes, like, floats in the hospital, like, throws some Christmas magic at Violet so she can wake up, then goes past Father Christian's wife, points at her, and Christmas magic goes into her stomach, and she gets pregnant.
Yep, and she, like, now you might be thinking, like, okay, well, then the next time she takes a test, she'll be surprised.
Mm-hmm.
At the end of the movie, she's talking to her husband, and she's like, I think I can feel it. I think that it's happening this time. And I was like, holy shit. Not only was she impregnated by Dolly Parton, but it was like palpable. She was like, whoop, it's in there.
Well, I guess, so this movie also has a very odd sense of what time is. So if we're going realistically off of the aesthetic of Christine Baranski's dance flashback, Father Christian is 45 years old because that dance was taking place in the 70s.
Well, that's crazy because he's... does not
no
they do not think he's not 45 years old and no.
Well, Josh Segarra is 34. I guess he was like probably 33 when they made it.
That's my guess. I mean, that's what it feels like. They are
early 30s, but that dance aesthetic is Saturday Night Fever. It is the 1970s. And you can't tell me I'm being nitpicky because you literally look at, like, there's not a single trace of any 80s at that dance. It is full 70s.
It is full 70s. Even the music, they like choose like a weird like disco-y track.
But on top of that, they have, you know, they've got Violet who goes into a coma, essentially gets brain surgery, comes out of the coma in about 20 minutes. They fly in someone from over 100 miles away in under 5 minutes. The preacher's wife can feel her newly inseminated baby after 5 minutes. This movie doesn't really understand how time works, which is fine, but, like, own up to it.
Yeah. And, like, at the end, like, the number, the big, like, it's Christmas number should be, like, the next day, but it also kind of feels like it's been a year.
Yeah. Well, I guess, like, it turns to midnight, so it becomes Christmas. Because the movie ends as it's about to become Christmas Eve, not even Christmas Day.
Oh, that's right, because they're supposed to leave on Christmas Eve.
Yes, and they're still there. Which this town has its priorities all mixed up because you see them packing before they go to the church to like pray for Violet's recovery, but also like they said they were going to organize a resistance. So I'm like, what is it? Like, are we packing? Because you got to be out tomorrow. Are you resisting? Are you praying? Like, what's going on? What's happening? And Jennifer Lewis does this whole like revival song with everyone in the church that basically is like, y'all have been singing your candlelight vigil. Now it's time to like wake up.
Yeah. It's, again, it is a movie full of questions and not answers. So exactly. If you are looking for an answer of any of those questions, you're never going to.
No,
there is no
gonna
answer to that question. But it's a happy ending and Violet wakes up.
Yes, she does.
And Christine Baranski's doctor is like, ah, you almost hit me with your car. And she's like, oh, sorry. And he's like, and also, by the way, you're not dying. And then you're like, oh, was she never dying? And like the whole change thing. Basically, the question is, was she, because she was like, oh, I can only see Dolly Parton. I'm going crazy. I have a brain tumor. And it's like, oh, I never had a brain tumor. So this must have all been real. That's one way of reading it. And then the other way of reading it is Dolly Parton cured her brain tumor as a reward for being a nicer person.
I never saw Christmas magic go into Christine Baranski's head. So I'm going to believe that it was never a brain tumor and that
Yeah, but the doctor's basically like, it's a Christmas miracle. And then like, she's like, miracle. She has like a moment where she like ponders that it could be
magic. Is it such a miracle that the scan got it wrong? I feel like that happens sometimes.
It is not that crazy for them to be like, oh yeah, we thought we saw shadows, but we didn't see shadows. Sorry. But like, that is another question that is never answered, because like, there is a moment where she acts kind of like, wow, I wonder if my life was spared by an angel because I'm a good person. But then the script seems to imply there was never anything wrong at all. You're not going crazy. It's all totally fine.
Exactly. And then you find out, so Christine Moretzky has this like big come to Jesus moment, literally, because she tells Father Christian, you're my kid. And then he does this whole sermon where he says, please welcome my mother.
My mother.
My mother, Regina Fuller. And everyone in the town's like, oh, Regina, Regina, Regina. She shows up all in white with the pastor's wife like holding her as she like walks to the altar. And you see Dolly show up on top, fully Angels in America, OG realness. Yeah. And Christine Moretzky's like, thank you. And Dolly's like, I'm the answer to your father's prayer. So it's like, I guess what ended up happening was, as her father was dying 6 months prior, he prayed to the angels to like help his daughter see the light.
Yeah, I think he prayed that his daughter wouldn't become a bitch, but if she did, can somebody go kick her ass, please?
So I guess that's our answer, is that Felicity's been working for her for 6 months, because that's when Dolly Parton was like, I'm going to give my angel in training to Christine Baranski.
And now, I actually think that makes sense.
And because Felicity hasn't been doing her job well, now Dolly's like, well, now I got to step in, which is why Christine Baranski's like, this is the first time we've seen homeless. It's like, yeah, because your assistant isn't doing her real job.
I actually think that is the correct answer, that she's been working for her for 6 months.
And I think that's a really great idea if it was more clear.
Yeah, there are so many ways that we could, if somebody had taken one singular second pass at this script, we would have had a lot of these things cleared up. But I think this script was written one time and one time only, and then it went right into production.
Absolutely.
And I think that's part of the joy of the movie.
That is absolutely part of the joy of the movie. So on a scale of 1 to 10 chocolate milks, how many chocolate milks will you give Christmas on the Square?
I mean, I'm going to give it 10 chocolate milks, because okay. I want to say, like, I kind of was talking about this at the beginning, like, I am not like a Christmas movie person, and like, I'm never going to watch like The Princess Switch and The Princess Switch 2. Like, that's not for me.
It's actually The Princess Switch Switched Again, but that's okay. That's simply Erasure.
Mamma Mia 2. Mamma Mia, here we go again.
Yeah.
So like, for me to have enjoyed this so much and to be like, I would watch it again next Christmas is like a lot. Do you know what I mean? For me to be like, not only did I enjoy this, but I would like make it part of like a Christmas routine.
Yeah, absolutely.
So, you know, that's pretty cool. I obviously, as you can tell, can't tell you what happened in the movie and the order in which it happened, because it makes no sense, but that doesn't matter.
No, I mean, the only reason why I can give it to you like bullet point is that I was taking notes this morning as I was sort of skimming through it. It also, like, it shouldn't take me 2.5 viewings and talking to you about it for an hour to understand the timeline of Dolly Parton and Felicity. Like,
yeah.
That's what we call, like, I don't know, implication storytelling, or like impressionistic. I was about to say, like, you know, I was about to be like, you know, the Monet type of painting.
Yeah, you know, it's like a bunch of little dots. If you stand too close, when you step away, it's Dolly Parton Christmas on the Square. But truly, like, it is the kind of script that, like, if they had one person take a pass through it who, like, wasn't originally on the team, I think they would have been like, oh, you know, you never say how long she worked for her, right? And they're like, yeah, you're right. Can I leave with a recommendation?
Yes, please.
A sincere one.
Yes.
So I'm going to tell you about a movie that I recently watched that has all female leads, was written by two women, directed and choreographed by women, produced by women, and had, I think, women costume design. Da, 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 da. It is on Disney Plus, and it is called Godmothered, and I loved it and I cried.
Okay, Isla Fisher's in that, is she not?
Yes, and Jillian Bell, who I think is like a true star of our generation, and I like love her so much.
How do I know Jillian Bell?
She was on Workaholics for a long time, which was not a big show. I like didn't love that show, but then she did Britney Runs a Marathon.
Yeah.
And she's like phenomenal in that movie. She was on that show on Comedy Central that I, again, also didn't think was amazing. That was like called like Babysittered or something like that. Either way, I think she is like one of the best comedic talents of our generation and is a sincerely good actor. And so like, unlike when you watch Rebel Wilson just sort of like saying lines in a weird voice, this is like a woman who like is a true character actor, and I like love her so much, and I thought the movie was great, and had a great cast of like complete and total weirdos, like Jane Curtin. You were like, why are you here? It was great. I loved it. And I was in an emotional mood already, but I did, it takes place around Christmas. So I feel like it like could be a Christmas movie and it made me cry. I loved it.
Okay. I'll get into it. So I do want to kind of end this episode on a positive note for the film. Cause first of all, I've been very open about how much I do love this movie, but I feel like every time I talk about why I love it, it's for the quote unquote wrong reasons. Yeah. So I do want to close out with an IMDb review that I found, pretty short. And then I'm going to go through the main cast and sort of say like a nice thing about each person in the movie. So on IMDb, Graham VR writes, best ever, the best movie ever that Netflix has had anything to do with in a long, long time. I do understand all the bad reviews here. It's Christmas. It's a Christmas movie. Wonderful songs, wonderful choreography by Debbie Allen. So the story is not what everyone wants, but it's lovely to watch. Great to see Treat Williams again. Dolly is magnificent. Watch it for what it is and enjoy the spirit of Christmas. All 7 inches of it. Mm-hmm. I remember reading many years ago that White Christmas got many negative reviews, but now it is a classic. That's the review.
And you know what? And that was a threat. That was a dot, dot, dot. That was like, and this will be a classic, so help me God.
I guess I would give it 10 out of 10 eggnogs, 4 out of 6 brain tumors, and I guess half of a Cheetamol.
Yeah, and 1 Douglas Sills cameo.
And yes, we didn't even mention that Douglas Sills plays Christine Baranski's dad. Sorry, Doug. And 3 out of 5 time lapses, and 4 out of 7 immaculate conceptions.
Yes, and 1 fan kick to end them all.
Exactly. Is immaculate the right word?
Immaculate Conception?
Yeah.
Isn't that what they say at Christmas?
Isn't it?
That it's the Immaculate Conception?
I think so. I have come to find out that I will either make up words or I'll take real words and put them together where they're not supposed to be.
My problem is I don't know anything about Christmas or the Bible. Oops.
Those are very different things.
We were like, you know that, you know, like the fucking heads up game that you play on your phone. We were playing it and we've like run out of things to do in quarantine. And so we're like, just like going to the packs that like nobody plays, one of which is the Bible. And we were playing it and they were like, I think I got one clue right out of all of them.
Mm-hmm.
It's sad.
All of my knowledge of the Bible comes from Jesus Christ Superstar and Joseph.
Children of Eden.
And Children of Eden. Well, no, because Children of Eden takes some liberties.
Well, Children I got Eden, one. I think I got one question right because of it.
Children of Eden implies that Cain killed Abel because he was trying to kill Adam. That is not the case. That's erasure, and everyone knows it.
Okay, well, not me.
Not you. I mean, that's.
I genuinely thought that was part of the Bible because, like, that's the only thing I know.
Has anyone ever made a Cain and Abel like incest porn?
You know they have.
It has to exist somewhere, right?
At the end, does he kill him with a rock?
A hard, hard rock.
See? Okay. So my guess is somebody's made it, and if they haven't, you got to get on it.
I don't know if he kills him with a rock, but he sure rocks his world.
There you go.
There you go. Okay, Allie, I think we've come to the end. We've talked about as much of Christmas on the Square as he possibly could.
We were just starting to cross into heresy, so I think it's a good time for us to stop.
Exactly. You can find Christmas on the Square on Netflix. Allie, where can people find you?
In my apartment all the time because it's still quarantine and we don't do anything. But if you are on Twitter, I'm at Miss Alice Nutting. That's MSALICENUTTING. Yes, it is reference to the mystery of Evan Drood. I guess I kind of regret it, but I kind of don't.
You can catch me on Instagram at Matt Koplik, usual spelling. We close out every episode with the lovely diva. We've already closed out with Christine Baranski.
Oh, no.
I know. And, like, I guess we could do Dolly. She's not really theater, but then again,
We can't do Angel Eyes for Mamma Mia. It's two divas.
We could. I don't know. I don't think so. You know what? I'm going to try and find audio of Debbie Allen from, like, Sweet Charity.
Hell yeah. There was actually a video that was going on recently, and it's pretty fierce.
Yeah. I mean, the woman was the most amazing dancer, but I'll find some audio for his charity, and she will be our diva tonight to close us out.
It also could be, I just want to throw this out there because we did mention this in the beginning of it, it could be there are going to be some changes made and ranking as a tribute also because we talked about that in the beginning of this episode.
We did. Tomorrow's the episode that's coming out tomorrow, or at this point it'll be 2 days before this episode, already has Anne Rankin. My view of time with this podcast is similar to how Christmas on the Square views time.
Yeah, it's whatever you want it to be.
It's 2 days before this and yet the day after. She's already being tributed in an episode. So we're good on that. Which also, side note, in my mind, Anne Rankin was never a singer. So like when I found out she did Cassie in Chorus Line, I was like, how does she do Music in the Mirror? That's like C's belted all the time.
She did it.
I found an audio of her in Good Time Charlie where she's like singing.
Yeah, she's wailing. And also she did Cassie with her hair down. I mean, like, talk about fierce.
Talk about fierce. And like had Michael Bennett re-choreograph that number for her.
I am obsessed. Yeah, anyway, so you can play whatever track you want right now, but I'm going to be going, you gotta change your ways today.
Oh, you're listening, Joe. I'm talking to you. No, she's phenomenal. No, it'll be Debbie Allen. We'll do Debbie Allen. All right. Yeah. So this is Debbie. Thank you so much for listening, guys. Go check out Christmas on the Square, either for Christmas Eve or Christmas Day or New Year's, whatever you want. It's honestly, it can be played at any old time as far as I'm concerned.
I agree. I think it's a year-long movie.
It's a year-long movie. What is time anyway? All right. No. Take us away, Debbie. Bye.
Bye.
Bells of St. Peter's in Rome. I'm tissue paper on a coal man. All kinds of music keeps pouring out of me, 'cause somebody loves me at last.
They say well-behaved women seldom make history. Just ask the Supps. A vibrant and wholly original new musical, Supps celebrates the real women who changed history and their story that is more timely than ever. See the show Variety calls an epic tour de force new musical. Deadline Cheers is a rare Broadway feat and leaves audiences inspired to keep marching. Supps has arrived on Broadway and not a moment too soon. Get your tickets today at suppsmusical.com. If you love Broadway gossip, you are not going to want to miss any episode of this podcast, Singular Sensation, The Triumph of Broadway. Plenty of dramas unfold on stage, but the best dramas unfold backstage. And there were no bigger dramas than behind the scenes of Sunset Boulevard.
So you were being crucified over here, but not there.
No. No, because I was turning in a performance that would get standing ovations. Excuse me.
So check out my podcast, Singular Sensation, for all the juicy and gory details of Sunset Boulevard.